going to scare the hell out of everyone because someone slipped an envelope under your door?
Alex, if this guy Calavera is trapped on the island, he's got no way off until the ferry tomorrow night.
Well, I guess unless he can't afford to have anybody get in the way of his escape.
What are you saying? He's going to kill us all?
That's what I would do, Maya said. Alex and I both stared at her.
If I were a cornered assassin, she amended.
Alex shook his head miserably. A nice dinner. All I wanted was a nice dinner to take everyone's mind off things.
He ripped off another piece of duct tape, slapped it across the doorway like a bandage, then trudged off down the hall.
He's hiding something, I told Maya.
Maybe you just don't like him.
Yeah, I don't like him. But he's also hiding something. He used to make fireworks when he was a teenager. Fuses, timers, trace.
A hitman using explosives and a kid playing with fireworks are two very different things.
Something is a little fractured about Alex, I'll give you that.
But he doesn't seem dangerous.
I don't believe he's never heard of Calavera.
What if he's the one who gave you the articles?
Well, that doesn't make sense either, I said. I don't think Alex reads.
Maya rolled her eyes. You really don't like him.
The plastic and boards and duct tape billowed and creaked against the ruined door, like some kind of artificial lung. I wondered if it was my imagination or if the wind sounded like it was lessening a bit.
If Calavera is here, Maya said, he'll need to leave. And if he knows that we know he's here...
Somebody knows. I tapped the envelope in her hand, and Longoria was shot. We have to assume Calavera is already desperate.
He can't have us raising the alarm. He can't risk getting quarantined on this island.
Yeah.
We're in serious danger, all of us.
Pretty much.
She took my hand. Want to go to dinner?
Yeah, I said. Dinner sounds good.
Chapter 12.
Benjamin Lindy pointed his gun at the mirror.
How had he gotten so old?
He recognized his eyes, sharp as ever, but his hair was thin and ghostly white. His face looked like the moon's surface, all scars and craters. The year he'd met his wife, 1963, seemed like yesterday. So did his daughter's birth.
How had he allowed so many years to pass?
To get this old and have nothing to show for it. Nothing but desolation, the loneliness of having outlived everyone he'd ever cared about. The gun shook in his hand. He swung it to the left, then the right. He found that if he did this, he could swing the barrel back to center and find his mark. He practiced on the ranch just to be sure. Thunder shook the mirror, and his reflection rippled. He lowered his hand. He hadn't realized how tight his finger had been on the trigger. The photo album lay open in front of him. All the happy moments were there. He tried to concentrate on them. But what he saw were other scenes, faces from photographs he'd burned. He saw his wife the day she left. The sun caught her hair and turned it from brown to gold. She wore a white cotton dress that showed off the freckles on her shoulders. The baby was crying in the house, but Benjamin ran out the front door after his wife. She didn't turn when he called to her, but he caught her in the driveway and tried to grab the suitcase, the same brown leather case she'd taken to Italy on their honeymoon. It spilled open, and her few possessions tumbled out, a few extra dresses, some lingerie he'd never seen. The only thing he recognized, a photograph, taken of her on vacation, standing in front of the Bray Mansion on Rebel Island.
"Goodbye, Ben," she said.
He was too stunned to stop her as she got in the car, leaving her things behind on the front lawn. Afterward, what stuck in his mind were her earrings, silver seashells. She'd never worn the jewelry he gave her, but she was wearing those, a gift from another man.
"I told you not to trust her," Jesse Longoria's voice spoke in his head.
Longoria, 30 years ago, sitting in his San Antonio office, cigarette smoke swirling through the hot light slanting through the window. He looked smug and confident in his caramel suit, his eyes black as a crocodile's. Longoria had counseled revenge.
You let her walk out on you, you're going to live with the fact that she's laughing at you every day. Sharing another man's bed, raising his children instead of yours.
Benjamin had refused, but the words irritated him for years, like a grain of sand at the core of a pearl. And this spring, he'd called Longoria again. This time, Longoria said, we do it my way. Benjamin remembered the hotel staff dragging Longoria's body through the kitchen on a plastic tarp. Longoria's eyes had still glittered darkly, as if being alive or dead made absolutely no difference to him. The gunshot wound was right where a tie tack should have been. So much for doing it Longoria's way. Benjamin heard footsteps in the hallway outside his room.
Mr. Lindy!
It was one of the college boys, the burly one, Marky. The boy seemed like the calmest of the three, the most polite. But there was a cruel light in his eyes that Benjamin didn't trust. Marky reminded him strongly of a young Jesse Longoria.
You lose your way, son. The liquor cabinet is in the parlor.
Marky's eyes registered the gun.
At dinner time, sir. You want me to say you're not coming?
I'm coming, Benjamin said. He set down the gun. He closed the photo album. Still seeing the picture that he'd burned long ago. His wife smiling in front of the Rebel Island Hotel. Smiling for another man. Chapter 13. I had to give Jose and Imelda credit. It's difficult to set an elegant dinner with the dining room windows boarded up and the floor littered with broken glass, but they'd done their best. Most of the furniture had been scooted aside, leaving one large table with clean white linen and settings for 10. Apparently, Jose and Imelda would not be sitting with us, which I thought a bit formal for a natural disaster. On the other hand, two more chairs would have brought our number to 12, like the disciples, and I wasn't anxious for this meal to resemble the Last Supper. No electricity, so the food was nothing fancy. Bean tacos, Vienna sausage and crackers, apples and cheese. Still cold beer, wine, bottled water. As Maya and I took our places, Mr. Lindy was in deep conversation with one of the college boys, the big bald one, Marky, who looked like a bodyguard version of Humpty Dumpty. Lindy was drawing on a napkin, showing him something like a football diagram. Garrett was telling Lane Sanford a joke, and Lane was actually trying to smile. Alex Huff was pouring Chase a glass of wine, explaining the difference between Merlot and Pinot Noir, and Chase was looking very confused. Imelda and Jose bustled around setting out plates and trying to keep candles lit, since the flames kept sputtering and dipping. There was no dinner music, but the storm against the plywood provided a rhythm track of pops and thuds and atonal moans. There were two empty seats. One for our missing manager, Chris Stowall, I guessed, and the other, Ty, the third college guy, was also not here. Maybe I shouldn't have put off Chase when he wanted to talk about his friend. Once everyone was served sausage and fruit and wine, Alex got to his feet and tapped his glass with a fork. He'd taken a few minutes to wash up. He'd bandaged his cuts, so his face now looked like it had been properly barricaded for the storm.
Well, here's to, making the best of it.
And the body in the basement, Marky added. Alex winced.
Hey, come on, Garrett said. Everybody, relax. Listen outside. The storm's lightening up.
That is the eye coming ashore, senor,
Jose said, as he refilled Garrett's glass. Everybody looked at him.
I have been in hurricanes before. Jose explained uncomfortably. That is the eye.
Well, whatever it is, Alex said, we can use the break. We need a little time to just relax and forget about, you know.
He glanced at me, silently pleading.
Being the heartless guy I am, I said, "We shouldn't relax." Now everybody looked over at me. I had a general idea how a cancer doctor must feel coming into a waiting room. Nobody wanted to hear what I had to say. Somebody slipped this under my door. I set the envelope on the table. It would be helpful to know who. Facial expressions are important. In those first few seconds, I tried to register everyone's. Alex, I'd already tested. Unless I had completely misread him, the envelope was a total mystery to him. Chase looked confused and uneasy, but he'd looked that way before. His friend Marky glared at me, holding his fork like a dagger. Benjamin Lindy narrowed his eyes. He barely glanced at the envelope and seemed much more interested in what I might be thinking. Lane Sanford looked terrified, as if her ex-husband might leap out of the envelope at any moment. And Jose and Imelda. They stood in the background, trying to be inconspicuous, but I saw them glance at each other. I wasn't sure what they were communicating.
Death threat? Garrett asked me. The killer wrote to you?
This isn't from the killer, I said. This is about the killer, a man called Calavera. Again, I checked everyone's reaction. I couldn't tell much. Jose cleared his throat.
Senor, this is the hit man they talk about.
Who's they?
Everyone, senor. The newspaper, sometimes.
I know who you're talking about, Mr. Lindy told me. Calavera, the assassin. He kills with explosives.
Did you ever work on a case that involved him, sir?
Lindy shook his head. I retired long before he started, but I know the name. I know he's murdered many innocent people. You believe he's here?
I felt the weight of everyone's eyes on me. I knew how badly they wanted me to say no.
I'm not sure, I admitted. But someone, probably someone at this table, gave me this information for a reason.
I told them about the newspaper articles and showed them the message, "Find him."
That's my hotel stationery.
Alex looked offended.
Wait a second, Garrett said. So now you're looking for two people? We got a killer, and we got somebody who wants to find the killer.
I nodded. As reluctant as I was to admit my brother was capable of logical thinking, he'd pretty much nailed it.
So, we got two empty chairs, Garrett said. Where's the Mexican kid? What's his name?
Hey, Ty ain't no killer, Marky growled. That's bullshit.
Well, what about that Chris guy?
As soon as Garrett said that, Lane stiffened next to him.
He ran the hell away as soon as the marshal was shot. Hasn't been back yet. How much you know about this guy anyway, Alex?
He's a local, Alex said. I've known him since he was like six. There's no way he could kill anybody.
Garrett scratched his beard.
Well then, where the hell is he? And where's the other dude, Ty?
Chase shifted uncomfortably.
I tried to say something privately to Navarre that didn't work.
It's all right, Chase, Maya said. What did you want to say? She did a better job sounding soothing than I would have. Chase scowled.
Ty's claustrophobic.
Garrett snorted.
This ain't a joke, man, Marky piped up. We brought him here thinking he could get over it, you know? It's been a nightmare. He's been drinking for 2 days just to keep from flipping out. Being on a damn island was bad enough, but now with the boarded-up windows, the storm, being trapped inside, he's really starting to crack.
Where is he? Alex asked. He sounded stunned that anybody could be unhappy staying on his island.
He ran out of the room about half an hour ago, Chase said. I thought maybe he just needed to walk the halls or something, get some air. I didn't want to embarrass him by making a big deal about it, but,
I prompted.
He wants off this island bad, Chase said. Bad enough to do something crazy.
There's no way off, Maya said. Jose and Alex exchanged jittery looks.
What? I asked. There is the fishing boat, Jose said, in the boathouse behind the hotel.
I stared at Alex. That's still there?
Why didn't you mention this before?
Oh, hell, Trace. It's just a little charter fishing boat. It ain't no good in choppy surf. It hasn't even got a full tank of gas.
But, senor, Jose said, if a man were desperate...
I cursed, then asked Jose to cover my sausage and bean tacos for later.
Come on, I told Chase and Marky. We've got some hiking to do.
Outside, the wind and rain had died to almost nothing. The air smelled so clean and charged with electricity, it hurt to breathe. The night was unnaturally black, no city glow, no stars, but I could feel the presence of storm all around us, like the walls of a well. Chase, Marky, and I all had flashlights. We wore attractive black plastic garbage bags as rain ponchos. As we trudged around the side of the hotel, the beams of our flashlights snagged weird images. Dead shrimp sprinkled in the seagrass, a child's orange life vest half buried in the sand, an uprooted palmetto, an outboard motor wedged upside down in the dunes, its propeller spinning lazily. And footprints. Fresh footprints sunk deep in the wet sand. They led toward the west shore of the island, where a covered boathouse extended on pylons over the water. A faint light flickered in the window.
"Does Ty know how to drive a boat?" I asked.
Chase shook his head.
"But that wouldn't stop him. I mean, the poor guy was freaking."
"We gotta yell before we go in," Marky warned, "so he doesn't shoot us."
"Whoa," I said. "He has a gun?" Chase nodded.
Marksman's pistol. He's a shooter on the college team. Didn't I mention that?"
Ty wasn't making much progress with the boat. He'd partially wrestled off the tarp, which now hung from the prow like a deflated hot air balloon. He stood in the boat trying to start the engine, despite the fact that it still sat on rails, 5 feet above the water.
"Yo, Ty," Chase said. "Come on down, dude."
Ty's expression wasn't much different from the many bail jumpers I'd nabbed over the years. Cornered, desperate, more than a little dangerous.
"Help me with this," he pleaded. "I gotta get out of here."
"Ty," I said, "you can't. You'll die out there."
"The storm's calming down. I can make it easy. I have to get out of this place."
Marky belched, which I guess was meant to be a gesture of sympathy.
"Dude, Ty, come on. The eyes passing over us is all. You'll never make it. Look at the frickin' water under you."
Sure enough, in the launching slip, green water was sloshing around, splashing everywhere. The boathouse floor was slick. The supplies strewn about the boathouse were soaked. On a nearby work table was a red canvas duffel bag.
"I tell you what, Ty," I said, "come back into the house for 15 minutes, just 15 minutes. We can sit and talk. If the storm is still dying down when we're finished, you can come back down here and I'll help you launch the boat. If the storm gets worse, you'll stay until the morning, and then we'll see."
Ty's left eye twitched. I tried to picture him on a firing range, shooting in a competition. It was a troubling image.
"I can't breathe in there," he said. "I can't go back in that house."
"Just 15 minutes, Marky said. "Come on, dude. That's fair. I'll get you a drink."
"I'll need a bottle,"
Ty said. His face was beaded with sweat.
"Sure," Chase agreed. "You can't start that boat by yourself anyway. You're a screw-up with engines."
Ty took a shaky breath. He started climbing down.
"You can take him inside?" I asked Marky. "I want to look around for a second."
"No problem."
Absolute confidence. I started wondering if maybe there was more to Marky than the ability to belch. Ty got out of the boat.
"Only 15 minutes, he reminded me. "Start counting."
"I will," I promised.
"And Ty, if you've got your gun..."
He blinked.
"My gun? Not with me. It's back in my room."
I didn't like the way he made it into a question. I looked at Marky.
"Find it." "Yeah, sure."
"And don't touch it. Put it in a bag or something.
bring it to me for safekeeping.
Marky raised an eyebrow, but then he nodded and led Ty away.
Hold up, I told Chase.
I walked him over to the work table and showed him the canvas bag.
Is this Ty's?
Never seen it before. Why?
A new red duffel bag in the middle of grimy bait buckets and tackle boxes and mildewed coils of rope. It was packed full, and what bothered me most were the shapes pressed against the canvas, like the bag was filled with bricks. I unzipped the top. Cash. 20s and 50s, all neatly bundled.
Whoa! Chase breathed. How much?
Quick estimate, about 20,000.
Dude, what's it doing sitting out here?
Good question. I fingered the old airline tag on the shoulder strap. It was an address different from Rebel Island, someplace in Corpus Christi, but I recognized the name.
Christopher Stowall, I said.
Chase swore.
That little turd! Stowall stashed this cash here? How the hell?
I don't know, I said. But 20,000. It's time I searched his room. I should have done that before.
Yeah, Chase said. If there's more money in there, we can, like, split it 50-50.
I stared at him.
What?
He said defensively. I turned and studied the fishing boat, the only way off the island. In the choppy water, the reflection from my flashlight beam looked like a fire, like flames in the window of a burning house.
Chase, I said, already regretting what I was about to do. I need your help with one more thing.
Chapter 14. Lane could still feel the impression of her wedding band, a month after she'd thrown it into the sea. She massaged her fingers, trying to get rid of the cold and tightness. Garrett placed his hand on hers.
Hey, it's going to be all right.
She studied his face. He was unlike any man she'd ever known, and not just because he was an amputee. She'd gotten over that, because he seemed so completely comfortable without legs. He sat in his wheelchair like it was a throne, a source of power. He wasn't attractive in any conventional way. His teeth were crooked and his gray-brown hair was a rat's nest. He had a pot belly and didn't seem to care much whether or not his Jimmy Buffett t-shirt had margarita stains on it. But he had nice eyes, surf green, full of humor and warmth. He smelled like patchouli and wood smoke. She liked the roughness of his hands and his gravelly voice.
"Things haven't been all right for me for a long time," she said.
"Hell, you don't know my brother," Garrett told her. "He's gotten me out of worse shit than this. I'm telling you, if there's a killer here, Trace'll find him."
"If there's a killer here."
A wave of guilt surged through her. She kept thinking the burden would get easier, but every day, month after month, it just got worse. She couldn't close her eyes without seeing the dead man's face. He'd smiled as she served him lunch. She remembered the knife, freshly sharpened for cutting apples.
"You know what you need?" Garrett asked.
Lane forced herself back to the present.
"What?"
"A tropical vacation in my room."
In spite of herself, she smiled.
"I'm not sure I know you that well."
"Trust me," Garrett said. "You'll find out plenty."
His room was strangely personal for a hotel room. The walls were decorated with posters of the Caribbean and the Florida Keys. They reminded Lane of Chris and how much she loved beaches. But she kept that to herself. On the dresser, Garrett had set up a full bar, rum, tequila, and triple sec, glasses, a blender, a bucket of ice. He'd hung different colored Hawaiian shirts on the shuttered windows. Music played from a little battery-operated stereo, Jamaican steel drums and guitar. A dozen votive candles flickered on Fiestaware saucers.
"It looks like you live here," she noticed.
"My favorite room. I come here a few times a year. Alex lets me keep it the way I like."
He mixed tequila and lime juice and triple sec over ice in a carafe, stirred it, and poured.
Margarita of the gods. No salt, Cuervo white. Mexican triple sec. My brother disagrees with me about every ingredient, thinks I'm a damn cretin.
You sound proud.
Of pissing off my brother? Hell yes! Salud!
The warmth of the alcohol knit into Lane's limbs. She sat in a wicker chair facing Garrett. She listened to the Caribbean music and the rain outside.
Earlier, you were talking like you admire your brother, she said.
Garrett sipped his drink. A droplet of margarita gleamed in his beard.
Sure, I admire him. I still like to irritate him.
You got siblings? Lane shook her head.
Then you wouldn't understand, but that's cool. I want you to take a vacation.
Garrett, he held up a finger.
No problems? No hang-ups?
Imagine those windows are open. You're looking out at clear blue sky and a calm sea.
Listen to the music, drink your drink, and relax.
Lane tried. She liked the feeling of Garrett sitting near her, confident and calm. Then she remembered the night in the woods. Her right eye swollen shut where Bobby had hit her. Her whole body ached. They dragged their burden into the woods wrapped in stained blue sheets.
You're crying, Garrett said.
I'm sorry.
Garrett's eyebrows furrowed.
What did that bastard husband do to you?
Before she could answer, she heard voices in the hall.
Can't believe you did that.
Markey was complaining.
I didn't have a choice, Chase protested. I'm telling you, Navarre forced me. He's a damn shut-up,
Markey hissed as they passed the room, probably noticing that the door was open. The sound of their footsteps faded down the hall. Garrett drained his margarita.
And my brother must be back. I'd better check on him.
Why? Suddenly, Lane didn't want to leave the room. She didn't want to go out there and face the others.
Trace is always where the trouble is, Garrett said, and I want to find out what's happening.
He put down his glass and held out his hand. Tentatively, she took it. He gave her fingers a squeeze.
We'll continue the vacation later, he promised. For now, let's go see what crap my little brother has gotten himself into.
Chapter 15. I was standing at Chris Stowall's dresser, going through his underwear drawer, when Garrett and Lane Sanford came in. I was about halfway through searching. So far, I'd come up with nothing except underwear, and I was kind of wishing I'd worn latex gloves. When I told Garrett what had happened at the boathouse, he arched his eyebrows.
You did what?
I scuttled the boat.
Hold up, hold up.
Garrett looked at Lane for moral support, then back at me.
You sank Alex's fishing boat, $40,000 worth of fishing boat, and you just...
Opened the bilge valve and sank it, I agreed. Now, are you going to help me search or not? Garrett shoved the underwear drawer closed so fast I almost lost my fingers.
Are you nuts?
I counted to 10, trying to contain the impulse to tip him out of his wheelchair. To my surprise, Lane interceded.
Garrett, Trace is right.
Garrett scowled at her.
Say what?
She put her hand on his shoulder.
We can't let the killer off the island. He'll hurt more people. Right now he's trapped here. We have to keep it that way until we can contact the police.
She glanced up at me.
That is why you did it, yes?
Yes, I said. I decided it was time to revise my estimation of Lane Sanford.
Whatever, little bro,
Garrett grumbled.
You're going to be in deep crap with Alex.
He nodded grudgingly toward the dresser.
What the hell are you looking for, anyway?
I don't know, I admitted. Something to explain the cash in the duffel bag.
What cash?
I told him about the 20 grand, which was now locked in the hotel's office, thanks to Jose and Imelda. I couldn't tell whether the news surprised Lane or not.
Damn, Garrett said. Find one more bag like that, and you can pay Alex back for his boat.
I decided to ignore him.
Being his brother, I'd had lots of practice.
Lane, I said, is there anything you can tell me about Chris, anything that would help?
I've known Chris since high school. He's a good person. He's not a killer, but...
She twisted the silver ring on her finger.
It isn't like him to disappear like this. He wouldn't do that. Something is wrong.
He invited you here for the weekend to get away from...
Yes.
Her tone was clear. Now was not the time to bring up her ex-husband. Chris didn't mention Marshall Longoria, I asked. Didn't make any comment to you about why he was here? She shook her head, but she was holding back. I could feel it as clearly as the storm outside. I glanced at Garrett, hoping he would help me out. He took her hand protectively.
Come on, Lane. It's getting late, and little bro, if you find anything else valuable, like more money or the keys to a Porsche or something, you might want to give me dibs on it before you destroy it, okay?
I turned Chris's room inside out. I didn't learn much. His stuff smelled of salt water and suntan lotion. He wore size 32 jeans. He liked extra-large cotton T-shirts. He had a picture of Waikiki Beach taped on his dresser mirror. There was a surfboard behind his closet door. Next to his bed was a guitar case. Nothing inside but a Yamaha acoustic and the lyrics to an old Nirvana song on a piece of crumpled notebook paper. No weapons, no duffel bags full of money. I found no evidence that he'd been packing. The closet was full of clothes. His toiletries were all there. In all, it seemed to be the room of a fairly simple guy who liked to surf and had taken a job that allowed him the time to do it. Too simple. Almost always, there was something interesting to be found in anyone's personal space. I called it the jalapeno factor. You had to have that little slice of spice on the nacho. I sat on Chris's bed and pondered that. Outside, the storm intensified. Wind battered the walls. The plywood on the window bowed in and out with a hollow popping noise. Had I checked the bed? I knelt down, and I slipped my hand between the mattress and the box springs. My fingers brushed against a book, and I brought out Chris Stowall's diary. I was about midway through reading it, far enough to realize I had trouble on my hands, when the college guys burst into the bedroom, Ty followed by Chase and Markey. The good news was that Ty had found his gun. The bad news was he was pointing it at me.
"You bastard," he said. "You wrecked the boat."
Ty put the gun down. Now that his friends had caught up with him, they didn't seem to know what to do. They had their hands out, crouching like they were about to catch a ball.
"Dude," Chase said, "I tried to explain."
"Shut up," Ty said. "You helped him. You told me I could leave in 15 minutes.
"Ty, listen to the storm," I said. "You couldn't have gone anywhere. The wind's already too strong." I didn't try to stand. I didn't look at the gun. I kept my eyes on Ty's, because I knew that was the best way to keep him from firing at me. Not a great way, mind you, but the best.
"You sank the boat," Ty's voice trembled. "You trapped me in this place with a goddamn killer. I'm gonna..."
That's when Markey hit him on the back of the head. Ty crumpled, and Chase tried to catch him without much luck. Ty landed face down on the carpet between the dresser and the bed. Markey pounced on the pistol. I checked Ty's head. He'd been hit in just the right spot to knock him out, directly behind the ear. I looked up at Markey. "Sap your friends often?" He opened his fist and showed it to me.
"I'm sorry, dude. No choice."
"You always carry a roll of quarters?"
"Pretty much," he said. "You never know."
Ty moaned. "Find him a place to lie down," I told him. "Not in here. And get him some ice."
"I guess I messed up," Chase murmured, telling him about the boat.
Markey snorted.
"You guys are whacked. Reckon the only way off the island."
"The killer may have been planning to use the boat," I said. "I don't want him to have options." Markey studied me.
"Dude,
You ever hear about cornering wild animals?
Once the guys had dragged Ty away, I finished reading Chris Stowall's journal. He wasn't a prolific diarist. The entries were sometimes 6 months apart. Then he'd write daily for a week. Then he'd lose interest again. He wrote about wave conditions. He made plans to move to Hawaii, where he'd apparently been once before on spring break. He had dreams of taking some girl named Amy there. They'd start a surf shop. At the bottom of the entry, he wrote, "I wish it was Lane." No explanation. He made some vague references to a brother, whom he affectionately called the Psycho. He drew pictures of seagulls and guitars. He wrote lines that might have been song lyrics. They were pretty bad. He also talked a lot about Alex Huff and how much they hated each other. According to Chris, Alex went on drinking binges about once a month. If there were guests on the island, Chris would have to scramble to keep Alex out of sight. Sometimes Alex left the island for days at a time and wouldn't tell anyone where he was going. When he was drunk, he'd get paranoid. He'd accuse Chris of snooping around his room, embezzling the hotel's money. "I'd quit," Chris wrote, "except I owe the bastard. I'm scared what he might do if I left. Maybe one more time, and I'll have enough to get out of here." I read that last line several times. I didn't like it. The final entry seemed to contradict the earlier one. It was dated last April. It read, "He wants to sell the hotel. He thinks he can just walk away. He can't do this to me." In the middle of the diary, stuck between two pages, was a folded printout of an email. The date was May 5th, exactly 1 month ago. The sender was a U.S. Marshal named Barry. I knew him vaguely. He was a higher-up in the West Texas District, based in San Antonio. Roughly speaking, he was Jesse Longoria's boss. The only time I'd met Barry, we discussed a deal to get a client of mine into the Witness Protection Program. The printout read, "We can talk, but it has to be in person. Specify a time and place." Below that, apparently clipped from the email to which Barry was responding, "At least 12 names, payments, instructions, enough to put my employers in jail for a long time, but I need absolute assurance. Any leak, broken promise, or hint of betrayal, and I vanish." I was still sitting on Chris's bed staring at his picture of Waikiki Beach when Alex came in and yelled, "You did what to my boat?" I didn't so much placate him as wear him down. He was too drunk and tired to do much more than yell and complain and throw Chris's clothing around. "Damn it," he muttered at last. He sank on the bed and buried his head in his hands. "That's it. That's just about everything gone now." I felt no satisfaction at his misery. As much as I'd begrudged him buying Rebel Island, I knew he'd be facing hundreds of thousands in repairs, assuming we weathered the storm at all. He had his life savings tied up in this hotel. I thought about Chris Stowall's diary, his descriptions of Alex's drunken paranoia. "I'm afraid what he might do if I left." "Alex, when we first got here, you wanted to ask a favor. What was it?" He laughed, a broken, unhappy sound. "Doesn't matter now. I was going to ask you to help me convince Garrett." "Of what?" "I'm selling the island, or I was, before this storm."
"Selling the island? You've wanted to own this island since..."
"I know." He stared at the boarded-up window. "I used to believe in this place. Now, I don't know, Trace. It's falling apart. This was my last weekend for guests. I have a couple of potential buyers. Thing is, I'd rather you and Garrett have it."
"What? The island?" He nodded.
"I thought Eli would have liked that. The idea of you guys keeping it running. You could do better than I did."
It seemed unnecessary to point out just how crazy that idea was. I mean, how could Alex think we'd have the money? How could he think I'd want Rebel Island?
Still, I couldn't help feeling a little honored. I remembered all the summers I'd come here before my parents got a divorce, and that small window of years when my childhood had seemed somewhat normal, before the day Alex took me out in that boat. "Neither of us has the money," I told him. "Even if I did, there's too much history here for me. This is a goodbye visit." I hadn't thought about it until I said it, but it was true. I'd come here to bury a lot of things. My memories of Dad, my PI work, my years as a bachelor. The whole idea of possessing this island made me feel kind of like Ty, like the walls were closing in. A cracking noise echoed through the house. Alex closed his eyes as if he were trying to sense where the damage was.
"I'd better go check that. Tell me about Chris," I said.
"Were you two getting along?"
He hesitated. "I told you. We've known each other forever."
I waited, but Alex didn't add anything. "Did Chris have a personal computer?"
"He used the office computer," Alex said. "That's it, I think. Do you have one?"
"A computer?
Hell no. I hate the things. Chris did most of my spreadsheets and stuff."
"I need to check the office.
The power's out. Computer won't work.
I still want to look around. Maybe sift through paperwork, any printouts Chris might have made."
"You're not thinking Chris murdered that marshal?"
"I don't know." I held his eyes. I didn't mention the cash in the duffel bag. If Alex had heard about it, he didn't mention it either.
"All right," he said. "I'll get Jose to show you. He helped Chris sometimes. Knows more about computer stuff than I do, anyway."
He took a deep breath like he was preparing for another round of battle.
"Now I gotta get upstairs. I think that damn roof just blew away."
Chapter 16. Maya hated the staircase. It seemed to get steeper every time she climbed it. She wasn't sure why Imelda decided to escort her, but she welcomed the help. Imelda held her arm, steadying her, encouraging her when she was out of breath.
"I feel like an invalid," Maya said. "You are doing well, Senora. Some day you will tell your child about this weekend."
"He's never going to hear the end of it."
"It is a boy?"
Maya stopped for a breath.
"Imelda, I don't know. I just started calling him him. I think so. My abuela used to dream the gender of babies before they were born. She told me..."
Imelda stopped herself.
"She was never wrong."
"About your own children?" Maya asked. Imelda nodded reluctantly.
"We are almost to the top, Senora. A few more steps."
They took the rest of the climb in silence. Maya imagined she was back at the house in Southtown, just going upstairs to the bedroom. No storm, no killers. Her doctor had thought she was crazy for agreeing to this trip. Trace didn't understand either.
"It's just Garrett," Trace had told her.
"We can say no. Hell, we should say no." But Maya had convinced him to accept. The last few months, she'd felt stifled. Not by the house, or by her marriage, or even by her decision to put her legal career on hold. She felt claustrophobic within her own skin. Just her and the baby, stuck in here for so many months, waiting. The idea of going somewhere new, seeing a place that was part of Trace's past, had intrigued her. Especially since it was a place Trace had never mentioned before, not even once.
"You spent every summer here?"
she'd asked. He nodded reluctantly.
"And did what?"
"You know, the usual stuff kids do at the beach." Maya imagined things from movies and books, or things she'd witnessed at the beach when she was an adult. Her childhood had had no beaches, no family vacations. Her only escape as a child had been climbing the mulberry tree to get away from the misery in her family's one-room shack, her father's depression, and her brother's illness.
"I want to see Rebel Island," she decided.
"No," Trace said, "you really don't." But the more he tried to dissuade her, the more curious and determined she'd become. With Trace, She always felt as if she were fighting to keep hold, always competing with his roots here in Texas, a place she had never understood. She was determined to weave herself into his territory, to be part of his landscape. Even after all that had happened this weekend, Maya didn't regret her choice. She just wished she understood why Trace disliked this old hotel and Alex Huff so much. Imelda helped her into the suite. She turned down the bed, but Maya didn't feel like lying down. She walked a slow circuit around the room, steadying her breathing. Water dripped from the ceiling, falling into the cup she'd placed on the dresser. The candle sputtered on the nightstand.
"Senora, you need anything?"
"Probably many things," Maya admitted.
"Can you tell me how you came here?"
Imelda blinked.
"To the hotel, senora. We used to live in Nuevo Laredo. It became too dangerous. We came north to Corpus Christi because I had a cousin there. We were very lucky to find Senor Huff."
Maya didn't ask if Imelda and Jose were in the country illegally. In South Texas, she'd learned. That was like asking someone what denomination of Christian they were. It hardly mattered.
"And how did you find Alex Huff?"
Imelda smoothed out the comforter, trying to make the corners perfect.
"By chance. Jose had been working construction, but work was slow. We went to the fireworks for the 4th of July to cheer him up. They have fireworks at the beach in Corpus Christi. Senor Huff was there, next to us, and he began telling Jose how the fireworks were made. Jose, he liked Senor Huff immediately. They both liked the fireworks. By the end of the night, Senor Huff had offered us jobs at the hotel."
From the little Maya had seen of Alex, she could believe he'd do something impulsive like that. Chris Stowall, the manager, had struck her as a similar hardship case Alex had taken in. Still, something about Imelda's story seemed incomplete.
"Imelda," Maya said, "your grandmother, your abuela, what did she dream about your children?"
The maid's face darkened.
"Senora, I should go. The other guests..."
She closed the door behind her so carefully, the latch didn't even click. Maya stood at the dresser. She looked at the old photo hanging on the wall. It was black and white, in a frame made from pieces of driftwood. Trace hadn't said a word about the photograph, and so at first Maya had paid it no attention. She assumed it was just another rustic decoration, no different than the stuffed fish or the nets with seashells. But when she studied it, she realized the photo was much more. It showed three men standing at the docks, the mansion looming behind them on a gray morning. The man in the middle had white hair and milky skin. He wore a dark robe over what looked like pajamas, as if he'd just been dragged out of bed. He squinted in the light, and his posture was stiff. The man on the left was a little younger, mid-40s perhaps, with a weathered face and sad eyes. He wore a Greek fisherman's cap and a plaid shirt and faded jeans, and he held a boat line in his hand. He had Alex Huff's crooked smile and beaked nose. Alex's father, Maya guessed. The third man dominated the picture. He was a large man in a crisp white shirt and dark slacks, eyes as black as gun barrels. He smiled, but there was no kindness in it. His face was flushed from drinking. A lawman. Maya could see that, just from his posture, the expression of power. He was used to people getting out of his way. He had Trace's face, but so different. It was Trace without his sense of humor, his self-doubt, or his kindness. Maya had known Trace for years, and this was only the second or third time she'd ever seen a picture of his dead father, Sheriff Jackson Navarre. Maya wondered why Trace hadn't even commented on the photo or tried to remove it from the wall. She doubted it was an accident the picture was hanging here. Perhaps Alex had put it in here as a reminder. Our families are tied together. Or maybe something less charitable. Maybe the message was more, "You owe me." Chapter 17. Before heading to the hotel office, I reread Chris Stowall's journal. One entry caught my attention. because it was one of the few written in detail. It described how Lane Sanford had convinced Chris to take the job as Rebel Island hotel manager. Lane Sanford had just gotten engaged. Chris was cryptic about the details, but he clearly wasn't happy. They were walking together at the seawall in Corpus Christi. Chris didn't record the time or the weather, but he wrote very specifically about what Lane was wearing. Her sleeveless dress was pastel blue. Her sandals were decorated with cowrie shells. Her hair hadn't been dyed blonde yet. It was ginger brown, braided down her back. Chris was trying to convince her that marrying Bobby was a terrible idea.
"You don't believe people can change?" Lane asked him.
"No. Look at me. I can't." It must have been chilly because Lane hugged her arms. Her fingernails were pink, which Chris found disturbing. She never painted her nails. She must have done it for Bobby.
"Chris, you've got to stop," Lane told him. "You can't keep doing what you're doing."
"I gave it up," he told her, but he could tell she didn't believe him.
"I know where you could get a job," Lane said. "Alex would take you in. He bought the hotel, you know."
Chris protested. Alex was an old friend, but they hadn't seen each other in years, not since Alex had joined the army. Besides, Alex had gotten a little weird ever since his old man died. How the hell could he afford to buy Rebel Island anyway?
"His father had some money," Lane said. "He never spent anything, and I think Mr. Eli wanted him to have the place. He sold it really cheap."
Chris didn't think much of Mr. Eli. The man had been creepy. Alex living on that island so long with just his dad and that old guy in the bathrobe, it seemed pretty damn strange. "I've got no experience," Chris said. "Nobody would hire me."
"Alex would," Lane insisted. "He believes in giving people a chance. He's got big plans for the hotel."
She took out a business card and pressed it into Chris's hands. He paid a lot more attention to the warmth of her fingers than he did to the card.
"Just call him for me?" she asked.
Chris gazed at the waves, thinking about surfing, how he would like to be out there riding the crests. Things were simpler in the water. The waves came to you. You just needed patience and balance. You didn't need to think too much or prove anything. You didn't get in trouble just because you wanted to make some money.
"I'll call him," Chris promised.
A week later, Chris wrote, "I took the job. It'll only be for a while. Besides, I've got an idea. I could have enough money for Hawaii in a few months." The hotel office looked like a hurricane had blown through, though it was one of the few rooms where the hurricane hadn't. Paperwork was strewn everywhere. Notes and old photographs overflowed the bulletin board. There was a wall calendar and two desk calendars, and as far as I could tell, none of them was for this year.
"Here, senor."
Jose handed me the phone bill from last month. "Please," I said, "just call me Trace." Jose had a quick, natural smile that would have gotten him labeled impertinent in school or the military. He probably didn't find anything particularly funny. His mouth was just shaped that way. He was built like a wrestler, low and thick and solid, with hands that could have crushed rocks. But his smile and the gleam in his eyes made him look non-threatening, almost cuddly. I decided not to share that observation with him. I scanned the list of calls from the hotel's landline. Most were to Port Aransas or Aransas Pass, some to Corpus, Kingsville, San Antonio, Brownsville, all the closest metropolitan areas, the places you might expect. "Can you tell me which room dialed which number?" I asked. Jose looked at the phone bill.
"No, senor."
"How about cell phones? Does Chris have one?"
"I think yes. But mobile phones do not work on the island."
"Don't suppose you have any idea where his might be?"
Jose shook his head. "Lo siento, senor."
I stared at the dark computer screen. No way to access the thing. I found some printed-out emails, but nothing interesting. Confirmed bookings, catering invoices, responses to creditors and guests. It looked like Chris had written most of the hotel's correspondence. There was nothing that matched the printout from U.S. Marshal Barry.
"Jose, how long have you worked here?"
"2 years, senor, in July."
"You like it?"
The work is good. I enjoy preparing the brunches on Sunday. Usually I make better than Vienna sausages.
I went back to the phone numbers. Something about them nagged me, but I couldn't pinpoint what.
Did Chris hire you? I asked.
No, senor.
A hint of distaste in his voice.
Mr. Huff hired me. Mr. Stowall, come later.
It seemed weird for Jose to be calling a young twerp like Chris Mr. Stowall.
They treat you okay? I asked. Chris and Alex.
Yes, senor. They have been most kind to me and Imelda.
Something in his voice, as if it were difficult to say Imelda's name.
You are married, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
I noted the shift from senor to sir. His tone had become guarded, maybe a little obstinate. I decided not to press him further. For one thing, I wasn't sure it would do any good. Also, I wasn't sure it would be wise. Despite the smile, there was an undercurrent to Jose that I didn't quite understand. I looked back at the phone numbers. Corpus Christi, Kingsville, San Antonio.
Jose, do you have the registration cards for this weekend's guests?
At the front desk, sir.
He looked relieved to have an excuse to go.
I will get them.
While I waited, I stared at one of the photos on the bulletin board. Alex Huff, as a teen, squatting at the dock with a rope curled in his hands. The boat in the photo wasn't anything like the $40,000 one I'd just scuttled. It was a simple 20-footer, the same boat Alex had once taken me fishing in. Despite all the time that had passed, the sight of it still unsettled me. That afternoon, 25 years ago, the sky had been clear and bright. We took the boat out so far Rebel Island seemed to sink into the sea. The water was green as chlorophyll, hot with the smell of salt and fish. In the distance, a shrimp boat trailed its nets. A mob of